you see helicopters constantly going past, and there are always emergency evacuations.
There's a point where I thought, I'm going to continue going. He is safe in this tea house.
I was just on my deathbed. By the end of the day, I just thought, there's no way.
What is that moment like?
It was a really big avalanche.
And you're on a cliff edge.
Did you actually get to see Everest?
You don't know what you're in for.
Everest Base Camp. It's one of those dream destinations people talk about, but few actually do it. Well, my friends Carrie and Briar just took that journey. Today, we're talking about what it's really like to hike through the Himalayas, face down altitude sickness, and reach the base of the tallest mountain on Earth. This is not just a travel story. It's about pushing yourself, testing your limits, and doing something unforgettable. Let's get into it.
How do we start this? Carrie and Briar, welcome to the very first ever, I don't know what we call this, the Trip Report podcast. Thank you so much for sitting down and having a conversation about this like awesome adventure you guys just went on.
Sure.
Why don't you guys tell me what you did and tell me a little bit about yourselves?
What did we do, Briar?
We climbed to the first base camp of Mount Everest. My name is Briar. And I just love to travel. I want to see the whole world and every single country.
And I'm Carrie. I am a homebody who married someone who loves to travel. And so I get to experience the world, which I always appreciate. Like every time we go on a trip, I am grateful for the experience that I had.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, she's the one that drives it.
What made you decide on going to Everest Base Camp? Like what was the inspiration for the trip?
I think it's just a spot Briar has always wanted to visit.
Yeah.
I mean, she wants to see everything in the world. And as much as, you know, we're not really interested in trying to summit Everest.
Yeah.
Because I don't need to die. And it just seems like more work than necessary. We summited Mount Rainier last year. So that was sort of our mountain, you know, climbing experience. But just to actually see Everest and then get as much of the experience as you can without actually going to the summit. And so that seemed like base camp.
I mean, going back to like seeing everything in the world, is there anything that's like driving that desire?
I feel just as a kid growing up in a very small town and you're learning about the pyramids in your history book and you're learning about the tallest mountain in the world. Like everyone knows Everest. And as a kid, there's just like pictures in a book that you think, wow, these are really cool pictures, but then as you become an adult, for me, I'm like, these are real places that I get to make my own decisions and I can actually go and see them and experience them and feel the history. Like growing up, I always was asking my mom, when can I leave this town? And she's like, when you're 18, you can do anything. So I feel like my whole childhood, I was waiting for my prison sentence to be up.
Yeah.
And as soon as that sentence was done, I just started traveling any way that I could and trying to experience more states, more countries. And it just snowballed from there.
And where did you grow up?
I'm from Glencoe, Minnesota.
Shout out to Glencoe, Minnesota.
Person town.
Little farm town.
And you're also from Minnesota originally,
yes.
Right? Yeah. And so you, on the other hand, you're a self-proclaimed homebody.
Homebody, yeah.
So how does it feel when you're out on the road? Like like you said, you're excited when you're there. But
yeah.
When you're thinking about going on these
I'm trips. Excited when I'm done. I appreciate everything that I gain from the experience. I always say I wish I could have had the experience without actually having to go through it. Like I want the results of it. I want the growth. I want the memories, but actually having to live through it. Sometimes it's fantastic. And then sometimes like hiking to Everest Base Camp, it can be somewhat painful.
Let's get into the actual hike itself.
Mm-hmm.
How do you even get to I don't know, is it a trailhead when you're trekking?
Yeah.
Or like, how do you even get to starting this adventure?
We flew into Kathmandu.
Okay.
And from there you can either take a helicopter or a light plane to Lukla. And Lukla is I think it's probably the closest airport
There's no roads to get there.
Yeah, you can't drive. There's no roads. There's a ton of villages along the way. And some of the villages have heliports and things for emergency evac and things like that. But as far as going to Everest, everyone, even people who are going to summit, fly into Lukla. And that's where you start the trek. From that point on, you have to walk. It's the only way to get there.
Wow. And how far is that?
From Lukla to Everest, it was 34 miles. Whew. One way. And that's mostly uphill. And then to come back out, it's another, we take a slightly different route. So then it's only 33 miles to come back out. So it was 67 miles round trip.
Wow. And you did this in how many days?
It's eight,
11 total.
Yeah. 8 days to get up there and then 3 days to come back out.
Wow.
So you take longer on the way up because you're acclimatizing as you go and adjusting to the altitude. So we topped out at 17,000 feet, which is really high. It's the highest we've ever gone.
Yes.
And, the crazy thing about the hike is, you know, people always want to know, is it a difficult hike? And the trail itself is not difficult. Mm. Like, we're here in the Pacific Northwest, and if you've hiked any of the, you know, the mountains around here, they're more challenging than this actual trail is. But because you're at altitude, that's what makes it hard. So you're walking so slowly, you don't even break a sweat. Like, we didn't have to change clothes for multiple days because...
Well, I don't know. I might break a sweat.
Maybe you would. But you're barely moving. Your primary goal is to not elevate your heart rate and to not start breathing. You basically want your whole body to be functioning as if you're just sitting still.
Wow.
And so you're barely moving forward because you have to get that oxygen in. And so it takes hours just to go a couple of miles. So the way up, the most challenging thing is the mental grind of walking so slowly for so long, for 6 to 8 hours a day, every single day. That's what's the hardest thing for me, was just trying to stick it out and keep going. And every day that ends, you're like, I can't do this for another day. And then you get up the next morning and you just go do it again.
Yeah.
And you just keep getting higher and higher, and the air gets thinner and thinner, and it's harder and harder to breathe. So the hiking itself, not difficult. The breathing is the difficult part.
Now, did you take altitude sickness pills or anything like that to help with that?
We did.
We did. And I think our guide, our porter, and our altitude medication are the only reasons we successfully accomplished this trip. Our guide kept us very focused in the moment of not thinking of the next day. Because like Carrie was saying, at the end of the day, you're so exhausted and so tired, and just from the altitude of not being able to breathe. For example, if there's not bathrooms on the trail, I'll take off my backpack and it's 10 feet to the rock that you're going to pee behind.
Yeah.
And so you walk just a little quicker because you can see it. You're like, oh, I'm just going to hurry up. And the time you get to the rock that's 10 feet, you're out of breath because you were walking at a normal pace. But the guy just kind of kept us at bay and kept saying, I've seen many hikers. I know you guys are going to make it. You have nothing to worry about.
He was always confident. You're going to make it. And we're like, I don't know if we're going to make it. He's like, you're going to make it. And he wouldn't tell us until after each day of how hard the day actually was.
Yeah. Oh, really?
So the second day is one of the hardest days. But he didn't tell us that ahead of time. He's right. Just like, it's going to be, it's going to be a long day. We got a lot of uphill to do. But it's going to be fine. You'll get through it. Don't worry about it. And then at the end, when we were just about crying from the suffering, and he said, oh, yeah, well, day two is always the hardest. this is the hardest
day. Everyone says day two is the hardest.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, he's really smart to not tell us that before the day. He tells us that after the day so that we can at least go into it with a positive attitude. And he just kept pulling us along the entire trek. He's like, I know you're suffering. I know this is hard. It's okay. You're going to be fine. You're going to do it. But right up until the day before we got to base camp, we still weren't sure if we were going to make it.
Really?
We were not. Yeah.
Every night I was like, I think I can make it to the next part tomorrow. We will see. I will make it as far as I can, but I don't know if I'm going to make it to the next tea house.
So you mentioned tea houses. Are the tea houses where you are staying the night and you're going from tea house to tea house?
Yes.
Yeah, they're usually combo tea house and lodge.
Okay.
And as you go, they get more and more primitive. So the first one we stayed at, the first day you fly into Lukla. So It's already midday by the time you get there and you get organized. Your porter grabs your bags and you're ready to go and you gear up. So you've only got a few hours of hiking that first day. Super easy. And then the first lodge is the one we stayed at, was just this beautiful, you know, wood lodge on the riverside. And they had a 4-course dinner and heated beds. And I mean, it was luxurious. It was wonderful.
It's the calm before the storm.
It's the calm before the storm. And then you go along and each day, you know, okay, you don't have heated beds anymore. And it's just a tea house. You just order something off the menu. You're not getting the 4-course dinner. And then, okay, well, now we still have a toilet in our room, but no shower. So it's community showers. And then the next one, oh, now we don't have a bathroom anymore. Now it's just a plywood box with a couple of mattresses. And we're using the sleeping bags now to stay warm. So as you go, as the trip is getting more difficult and you're getting more drained and you stop eating because at altitude you lose your appetite. So now you're just fighting to get calories. And as everything gets harder, the rooms get more and more primitive and you lose amenities and now you can't shower and you don't have a bathroom in your room anymore. And it just gets tougher and tougher until, I mean, finally at base camp, we stayed in tents. But by that point, we'd reached our goal, so I didn't care anymore. But yeah, all along the way, it just gets more and more difficult because as you get further and further from Lukla, any supplies that go to those villages has to be carried there on somebody's back. So it gets... they get smaller and more basic.
So how do you deal with that mentally as you're trudging along and knowing that the next place is not going
probably
to be very nice?
Yeah.
I feel for me, once you get to the location, you're so happy that you just have shelter and a place to lay down because you're so exhausted that you really just, for me, I just didn't care. I was like, wow, I don't have to go outside to use the bathroom. Like, yeah.
It's still better than it could be. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
At least I have something over my head. So you said you don't really end up having an appetite as you're going higher and higher.
Yeah.
Which I just realized, isn't Everest just under 30,000 feet?
To the top, we went to 18.
Yeah. So you went a little above halfway and then these other people are going
all the way.
Yeah.
The same amount higher.
Right.
Well, that is like brain. That's why that hurts my brain. Yeah.
We actually had oxygen with us for emergencies, but we didn't have to use it, fortunately.
Yeah. So as you're going, you lose your appetite.
Yeah.
The accommodations are getting more and more simple.
Yeah.
could you feel any other changes in your body as you're like walking up, going higher?
It affects your sleep.
Yeah.
I think probably people who have gone skiing like at Vail or something have experienced that too, because the lack of oxygen during the night, it keeps waking you up and you're like gasping for air.
Oh.
So all through the night, I just keep waking up gasping for air. And so you're also not sleeping very well. So that contributes to the general just degradation of your whole physical being. Mentioning the altitude medication.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, and I always thought you bring that along in case you develop altitude sickness and then you take the medication to cure it. And our doctor said, no, I'll prescribe you a full week and a half's worth and just take it the whole trip because you can use it as a preventative. And I never knew that. And I think that was critical too. We were both taking it every single day as a preventative.
Day and night. You take it twice a day.
Otherwise, I think it would have been much worse. Mm-hmm. if we had waited. I don't know how you could get through that trip without developing altitude sickness, just because of all the physical activity and the lack of food and the lack of sleep. And I just feel like your body's going to succumb at some point.
Mm-hmm. So you're worn down throughout this trip, but I'm assuming it's beautiful as you're hiking up.
Oh, the views are spectacular. Yeah. It's like nonstop. It's every second of every day, you just have these incredible vistas.
So you start off and there's still like trees, or you're like under the tree line. So it's like more foresty. And then the first couple of days, you have all the suspension bridges that are going over the rivers.
Yeah, you're following a river valley.
Yeah.
So you're constantly crossing back and forth.
Just hiking along the river valley. So you're looking down the valley and down at the river. You're just following the river and the valley, which is gorgeous. And then, as you just get higher and higher, less trees until you're just on a glacier, just rocks. And every step is difficult because there's no path. It's just big boulders that you're walking over.
Yeah, a path can't develop over the years because it's constantly moving and changing. So there's a general route, but really you're just picking your way across the boulders. But yeah, once you get above the tree line, then it's pretty much just like a desert scene, but still huge mountains. And
yeah,
we only had a couple hours of snow on our way back out and a couple hours of rain, but the rest of the trip was perfect.
Is that a function of just like the time that you guys chose to go?
I think it was just good luck. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because even other people were commenting of like how much great weather we were getting.
Oh, nice.
So I think it's a bit more varied typically.
So as you're going up, you said there were, you weren't sure you were going to make it, you know, the next day. Were there any times where it was to the point where you're like, I'm ready to, turn around?
I feel like for Carrie, yes.
Yeah.
There's a point where I thought Carrie's going to stay at 14,000 feet. I'm going to continue going. He is safe in this tea house. And we will walk back for him because what comes up must come back down.
Yeah.
And yeah, but he somehow made it. I am very proud of him.
We had
pushing through.
Yeah, for the 8 days going up, there's 2 days that you don't progress. You just do an acclimation day. And so you do a day hike up to a higher spot, take some pictures of something, hike back down, and then stay at the same lodge again. And so that just allows you a little bit more time to adjust to the altitude. And so one of the nights that we arrived, it was the second, I think, the second acclimation day.
Yes, it was.
We got there that night and I started to feel a little bit off and I went to dinner and I wasn't feeling so great. And I went back to the room and suddenly I was just deathly ill.
All hell broke loose.
Horribly, horribly sick. Fortunately, we were still at a lodge where we had our own bathroom.
Yes.
Because otherwise it would have been a nightmare. And so the next day, you know, I was just on my deathbed. And so I didn't do the day hike, but at least we weren't going anywhere. So I was able to just spend the whole day in bed. And Briar went and did the day hike and she came back. And by the end of the day, I just thought there's no way. Like, I can't recover from this and start walking again tomorrow.
Our guide was like, you'll be fine by tomorrow.
He said it's a 24-hour thing. Just keep drinking electrolytes. I'm like, I can't even keep down one sip of water and I'm supposed to, like, it's just impossible. There's no way. But by the next morning, I'd taken a lot of drugs and I was just thinking about, I'm going to have to stay here in this room for 2 or 3 days while they finish the trek and then come back to get me. And I just thought that's going to be so depressing. I can't even imagine doing that and then not getting to base camp. So I got up the following morning and I dragged myself out there and started walking. I mean, fortunately, like I said, you're not walking fast. You're not working hard. But I still felt very sick. And so it just made everything that much more difficult.
Yeah.
So I was down to about 2 orange segments per meal. That was about all I could eat. It wasn't until we got all the way back home
that
I started to feel normal again.
And did you have any?
I got a little bit sick the last day. So I think mine was a little bit more possibly like food poisoning or some bad water because we weren't at altitude anymore. But not as severe as Carrie in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. So aside from almost dying in a tea house, were there any other scary moments like on the trail? Anything that was like super thrilling or exciting that happened?
We saw an avalanche.
Oh, yeah.
That was super cool. So it was on the way to the base camp, and it was a really big avalanche. I mean, it's my one and only that I've seen in real life. But seeing how big and quick it was and like watching it and like counting the seconds that it literally took out, I don't even know how many, I would say 2,000 feet within 10 seconds. Like it's just whoosh.
It went down the whole side of the mountain and I couldn't get my camera out in time to get a shot of it
before it was wild. But you can see just the force and the quickness. Like if you were stuck in an avalanche, there's really, you can't run from it. It's,
just,
it's too fast. It's too sudden. And even like we just saw it for a split of a second. And yeah, it was just, I was like, I want to see it again because it went by too quickly.
I don't think there are really any other scary moments. It's like I said, the trail itself is not challenging. So it was never really, you always felt like you were pretty safe and secure. There was one river crossing that was a little tricky, but not terrible. And a few times that the trail would get pretty narrow and you're on a cliff edge and you're like, oh, if I slipped right here, and it's all gravelly. If I just lost my footing or something, I'd be gone. But you just pay attention, and you're careful for that minute that it takes to traverse that section, and then it's not a big deal. So, no, I mean, that's kind of the nice thing about it is, as difficult and as grueling as it was, like, I wouldn't claim that it's something that people shouldn't do if they want to. There were a few people we saw on the trail that were like, oh, I don't think that person's going to make it. Okay. And then in one case, we were correct. A guy got emergency evac'd on the helicopter. And you do see the whole time you're trekking, you see helicopters constantly going past. Mm. And they're always emergency evacuations. So
you can tell because they're flying lower.
Yeah.
So
to try to reduce altitude.
At the altitude, yeah. Oh. But the helicopters were kind of neat because we're on the trail. And that's kind of a scary moment because you're not used to them flying so low that you literally feel like your head's going to get chopped off.
Fly right over
they
your head.
They fly yeah. right over you.
Oh,
like
wow.
On the side of you. And I mean, I know that they know their distance, but it's still daunting because it's just yeah. something I've never experienced before, that many helicopters flying so close.
Well, in terms of the kind of people that you saw on the trail, I mean, there's the guide, the porter, mm-hmm. and then the people who are doing the hike. What yeah. what kind of person signs up for this?
Apparently hell. Everybody.
Yeah. Was there a lot of people?
We saw kids, we saw old people and everything in between. This was peak season for it. Mm-hmm. So we were warned it's going to be busy, and it was busy. Like there were times the trail was pretty packed. And besides of all the hikers, you know, this is their main highway. Mm-hmm. So there's tons of porters coming and going, and they're just single mind. You know, yeah.
they
have this massive load on their back, and they just want to get to the next destination and drop that load. So they are booking it through there, and you have to get out of their way. And then there's long trains of yaks or donkeys that have supplies on their backs, and they come through. They're basically like when you're on a road trip and you're constantly dealing with semis.
Yeah.
There's always like semis on the road and they're passing me and I'm passing them. And that's what these wagon trains were. It was just these long rows of animals and you'd always have to get to the side and wait for them to all pass. And then you could start hiking again. But sometimes yeah. they'd be coming and going multiple directions. Sometimes they collide with each other and the animals start to get mixed up and they have to sort them out and figure out which ones are going which directions.
Oh, gosh.
So there are times the trail gets pretty chaotic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I bet that's pretty novel, like the first day. When it's, you're like, oh my gosh, yeah. yaks. Yeah. And then you get over that pretty
quick.
It's
super unique, and then it just becomes annoying.
Yeah.
And then you start to get tired of smelling the animal dung on the trail or watching your step everywhere you're going. But I don't know, it's part of the whole experience. It all fits together. It all makes sense.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, everything after, you know, day 7 or 8 starts to get a little grinding on you.
Yeah.
A little bit of
totally.
I think it's like the only probably place in the world that you can experience what life was like before trains, cars. Like in our history books, we learn about people that were traders and they're walking to different villages and bringing their camels or their donkeys and seeing it firsthand. Like you really feel like you're living that history, watching people literally carry everything up a mountain. So I feel like that was a really special and unique experience that you can't get anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, that's an incredible way of looking at it, is this look into the past of what life would have been like.
And it makes you super aware every stop you make along the way, especially as you get further in. Everything you eat or consume or just use or take, like every resource, it's so implanted in your brain now that somebody walked that all the way. And you've been walking for 6 or 7 days and you've been suffering and working. And you're like, somebody carried all this out here.
Yeah.
And they do it on a daily basis. And I don't want to take or touch anything because it took so much work to get it here that I feel really guilty consuming these resources. And I mean, there's buildings, there's lodges, there's tea houses, and all those materials had to be carried out. You see a lot of porters carrying construction materials. Mm. They've got lumber on their back. They got rebar. I mean, plywood, anything that is going into construction has to be carried out. Furniture is all carried out there. That's why they don't have a lot of refrigerators and things, because you have to carry them on your back. It's pretty wild.
So the porters get paid by how much they can carry.
Okay.
So the strongest porters can carry up to 270 pounds.
Wow.
It's just like a strap on their head with ropes and just on their backs, and they're all...
Yeah, the whole thing is carried on their neck.
On their neck weight. And I just can't imagine carrying 270 pounds.
No.
I mean, these are the high-end porters, but...
So tell me about the moment you guys are getting up to base camp. You've now, you know, purged the demons. Mm-hmm. You're eating
purged all the demons.
A single orange slice at each meal.
I eat ramen for every meal.
You're having ramen for every meal.
Yeah.
What is it like? And what is it like day eight? By the time you're
day eight, yeah.
Getting up there, what is that moment like?
I feel like it was underappreciated for me. Like, in some ways, I was, like, so exhausted that I wanted to be like, wow, we did it. But it was just kind of like, finally.
It's this, like, immense sense of relief, like, that you wish would be more revelatory. You really want it to be this. I would say that moment was actually before you get to base camp. I don't even know the distance, but maybe a couple of miles, because base camp is sort of, it's
in another
a mountain
valley.
And then the glacier comes down a valley. So you're pretty much the whole time walking on valleys, and you come around a bend, and that's the first time you can see the base camp, and you don't even realize that's what it is unless somebody tells you, because it's, you don't know what you're going to see, and it doesn't look like what you expect. But you see this little tent village, yellow tents on this glacier. And he's like, that's base camp. And you see it off in the distance. And that's the moment you're like, oh, wow, we're seeing it. It's actually there. And the weird thing is, you come in from above. So it's below you.
Oh.
And you're like, wow, we get to walk downhill to base camp. What a dream. This is going to be fantastic. And then that last run is really difficult. And by the time you actually walk into base camp, you're just kind of like, thank God. I'm so glad this is over. And most people, the typical itinerary is you walk to base camp, you take pictures, and then you hike back out. And
oh, you don't even get to spend any time.
Yeah, you don't stay. Because normally it's full of people that are going to be climbing. So because Briar apparently, you know, when she planned the trip, she said, we want to stay at base camp. I didn't know about any of this. But so they actually worked out a couple of tents from one of the groups that had already started their trek. Started their climb, and we got to stay in those tents. But so anyway, most people turn around and leave.
Yeah.
We knew we were going to get to stay, which I was happy about, because I did not want to hike back up the hill we just came down. And we're like, so where are our tents? And he said, oh, they're at the far end of camp. And this camp is huge. It had to be.
It's an hour hike to get
It was another hour to hike through the camp to get where our tents were.
Yeah.
So then that whole time, I mean, our guide, like, he's taking pictures for us, and he's like, look at this and look at that. And the whole time I'm just like, this is all spectacular, but I so don't care. Yes. I just want to get to some place where I can take this pack off and I can sit down and not have to walk anymore today. So it was disappointing in that I didn't get to have the uplifting emotional response that I wanted to have.
Yeah.
But I sort of feel that in retrospect, looking back on it,
yeah.
Looking at the pictures and things, I can have that reaction because I'm not exhausted anymore.
Yeah.
But in the moment, I think the best moment thing was we finally got to where our tents were, and the crew that works the camp was there. And so they sat us down out of the wind in a warm tent, and they brought us some hot tea and everything. And then
popcorn.
And I saw a popcorn kernel on the floor. I was like, do you guys have popcorn out here? And they're like, yeah, we'll get you some popcorn. And they brought us a bowl of popcorn. And it was just, I mean, I love popcorn. And so it was this wonderful moment of just sitting at Everest Base Camp with a hot tea and eating popcorn. And I was just like, all right, we've made it. Like, everything we wanted to accomplish, this is it. We've succeeded. That was pretty great.
It's probably the only day when we went around that bend and you're seeing the base camp from a distance. I was like, I will make it to base camp.
Yep.
So you know in that moment.
I'm going to get there.
I'm going to get there. And that's probably the only day that I knew I was going to make it to the next destination.
Wow. And so did you actually get to see Everest, the mountain?
That's an excellent question. So the interesting thing about Everest is doing everything in its power to look like the smallest mountain in the world.
Really?
Yes. So like when you fly in, you can kind of see Everest if it's a clear day, and it's like hidden behind all the mountains. So there's other mountains in front of it making it look bigger. So your perspective, they're like, it's the, you know, the small peak.
The little one.
The little one. And then you get to 10,000 feet and then you're getting your second views of Everest. And it's the same thing. Like it's along other mountains and then you're like, oh, it's the little one hiding back.
The other mountains are all closer. Yeah. And they're so big and spectacular. And then you just see the top of Everest kind of peeking through.
And then you're going down the valley. At base camp, you can't see it, but on the valley, you can see Everest. And it's the same thing where you would think by the first base camp, you'd be looking up at it being like, ah, I see you. But it's still behind all the mountains and looking smaller.
That's so weird.
So you really get very few views of actual Mount Everest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You get these peekaboo moments along the whole trek where you can just see the top. But that's about it.
So everything about Everest, it just doesn't seem to want to be climbed. It's like, I'm looking small over here.
I'm hiding back behind these other mountains.
And I have this big, massive frozen waterfall you have to hike up through to get to me. Like, it seems like it's always just blocking you.
So you said you were able to find a way to finagle some tents to stay overnight. Mm-hmm. That kind of leads me to wonder, how do you even plan a trip like this?
We used to travel company.
I think it was called Dreams or something like that.
Yeah.
The one in Nepal.
They're from Nepal.
Okay.
So I like to do all my travels. If I can find a company that specializes in it, then everything's kind of like set up and ready for you. And you can tell them like what you're looking to do. Like if I was ever going to do the trek again, as an older person, I would say, is there a longer version of it? So I could rest for even 3 days at 10,000 feet, rest for 3 days at 14,000 feet, like whatever it might be to get more time to acclimate.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's an option or not, but I feel like our trip was the fastest paced trip to get there, like the bare minimum, which is 11 days. And if I did it again, I feel like I would want to take at least 15 days at a minimum to make it more like not rushed and
a little more chill
and chill. Or if you got sick, just a little bit more prep time.
A little wiggle room.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
So if you're talking to somebody who is interested in going up to Everest Base Camp, what advice would you give to somebody who's trying to do that?
I would say bring ski goggles.
Okay.
Even though it's not snowing on you.
Ski goggles and a buff. Snow was not an issue. Like, we were prepared for snow. We had gaiters. We had micro spikes, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And we didn't need any of that. It wasn't until we got to base camp that we even saw any. And it wasn't snow. It was just solid ice.
Yeah.
So there was never an issue. Maybe other times a year there's more issues with snow. I don't know. But yeah, we probably could have packed a little bit less, but you're not carrying your own stuff, so that's your porter's problem. I don't feel like it took a ton of prep. You want to have some physical activity, do some hiking.
Yeah.
Make sure you have boots that aren't going to blister your feet or anything like that.
Yeah, I would say that's key. Make sure you have very comfortable boots, so comfortable that you, when you're walking in them, you don't realize you're walking in them.
And You mentioned it was really cold at night. So was it cold during the day? Or you bundled up pretty?
No, it was pretty nice.
It was pretty nice.
When the sun was out, it was warm.
Yeah.
And then at night, it would cool off. But, we usually just slept in our warm clothes. Definitely at base camp in our tents. Like, then we slept in our parkas and everything.
Yeah.
In the sleeping bag. But, no, it was never that bad. There was nothing, other than just the mental drain of doing the hike, there was nothing like extreme about it, like extreme cold or extreme weather or extreme difficulty. Like, nothing was extreme. You just need to be reasonably fit, ready for a challenge, and most likely you'll get through it.
They say the word bestari bestari, which means slowly, slowly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just keep bestari bestari.
It's just the mantra.
You make it all the way up the mountain.
What's it like when you're I'm back in Lukla? Do you stay in Lukla or do you go back to Kathmandu?
We stayed a night in Lukla. Mm-hmm. The trek back out is weird because it's completely different than the way in.
Yeah.
Because the way in is bistari, slow and steady. And then the way out, you do that entire trek again in just 3 days. So now you're booking it.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, the way in, like I said, I never even broke a sweat. You're barely moving. The way out, everything was sore because now you're moving at full speed. You're going downhill, which, you know, is kind of hard on the hips and the knees and stuff. And now you're doing like 12 miles a day.
You're doing twice, like, so every 2 days going up is what you're doing on like the way down. You're covering 2 days of ground on your way out.
So you're passing places that you had stayed on the way in. Yeah. And you're like, oh, wait, we have to go to the next one now? Yeah. Oh, man. Fortunately, a lot of it is just backtracking the same trail. Fortunately, one little stretch of it, you kind of diverge and take a different route, which was nice. You had some new scenery there. But yeah, the way out is, that's the physically challenging part because you're going long days, you're hiking long distances, and your body just starts to wind down.
Yeah.
But yeah, then you get back to Lukla. We got there just before dark because that was a long last day.
Very long day.
Spent the night there and then hopped on the helicopter the next morning and flew back to Kathmandu.
And then we saw new people that were going to get on the helicopter to start their journey.
Yeah.
And they had brand new poles and shiny backpacks.
All their fresh, clean gear.
Clean clothes.
Makeup on. They're looking good. They're ready for their trek. And we're getting like, off the helicopter just beat. Just beat. They're pulling our bags out and they're all covered with dust and grime. And we're just like,
oh. Animal poo.
Yeah.
You don't know what you're in for.
Have you ever heard of this concept of like three types of fun, type one, type two, and type three fun?
Mm-mm.
No.
So there's this concept of like type one fun. It is fun in the moment. Like I'm at a circus and I'm having cotton candy. Yeah. This is fun.
Yeah.
Although like, I don't know if circuses are fun anymore. Type two fun is like, it will be fun when I'm done. And then type three is just not fun.
Right.
But sounds like this is type two fun, where it is delayed gratification.
It is.
100%.
It is fully really hard in the moment, mentally exhausting, challenging to get through it mentally. And then you're just happy that it's over.
Yeah.
Yes.
The first 2 days are, well, the second day is the hardest.
The first day is fun.
The first day is amazing because it's all brand new and the view, you're seeing these views for the first time. And everything, you're just so excited and so happy. And then by the end of the second day, you're really beat down. You're like, oh, yeah, this is going to be tough. You have moments of fun.
You do.
Because the views are so beautiful, or you get to see a particular wagon train of really interesting yaks go by. And it's just, those moments are cool. Or when you stop to take a break at a tea house and you have a hot chocolate and it's a nice day. You're sitting outside in a cool breeze and you're just watching the people go by and... So there's those moments of, like, calm, which is enjoyable and satisfying. But, yes, overall, it is delayed gratification. You really just want to get home and contemplate what you've done. But you don't want to be doing it anymore.
Then you have a very long flight home to think about it.
Yeah, 16 hours. So it's
I was so happy to get on that plane, though. It was, like, the first time I was looking forward. I'm like, I get to sit for 16 hours
and I don't have to walk, except from here to the bathroom on the plane, and that's it.
Great. Sign me up.
All right. So, lightning round questions. Window or aisle?
Aisle. I got to be able to get up anytime I want.
Window. I have to be able to sleep the whole flight without being disturbed.
Yep.
And then I can sit in between you guys.
Perfect.
Mountains or beach?
Mountains.
Mountains.
I mean, this is about hiking to to Everest Base Camp. It would be weird if you said beach. One country you could go back to, visit over and over.
I don't know. Each place is so special. Fine. I'll just choose Antarctica. Because we've been there twice, so.
Okay.
It is. I don't like repeating places.
I was going to.
It's the only place we've repeated.
I was thinking of that because I do want to go back, but then I was like, how many times could I go before I run out of things to do? I'm going to say New Zealand.
Oh, okay.
I think I could keep going back there.
If you want to hear more about their trips to Antarctica, you got to give this a like because then I'll know to get these guys back on this very important podcast that's going to blow up your YouTube channel.
Oh, it's
going to be crazy. Ooh, overrated travel destination.
I don't know, Cancun?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Cabo.
Cabo?
Yeah.
Some of the resort towns.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most essential item in your pack.
I'll go with my new laundry wash bag. It's like a dry bag, but you fill it with water and there's like soap dryer sheets, basically. So it's not like liquid, so they don't like leak, or if you're doing a carry-on, and you just put it in the wash bag of like, you get like three items. I'd say two pairs of pants and a shirt. So not a lot of laundry. And then you roll it up, or you fill it with water to the mark, roll it up, and it has like scrub bottom. So it's just, you like shake and scrub the bag.
Oh, that's awesome.
And you just wring your clothes out and then hang them to dry. But if it's like, if your clothes aren't like completely soiled and you just need like just a little bit of freshness, but you want to pack less. And then all my clothes that I bring on travel are like quick dry material.
So. That's cool.
Yeah, my is a new one as well. It's a travel bidet.
Oh.
It's for anyone who is not familiar with bidets, I'm telling you, it'll change your life. So yeah, it's just a little collapsible travel
That's cool.
bidet thing, which is, it paid off on this trip. Because you have fewer and fewer bathrooms, and then they don't have toilet paper anymore, so you have to carry your own, and so you don't want to use more than necessary.
What is a place that has surprised you the most?
Poland.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know what I expected, but it's a wonderful modern country. I mean, we drove the whole time, so the roads were fantastic. The cities were great. The people are great. It was a really cool country to explore. It's one of the trips that we did with zero planning.
Yeah.
We just had plane tickets and we knew where we were staying the first night, and then the rest was just going to wing it. And the trip was fantastic.
Choose, you know, a place that everyone can go to from America is Guadalajara, Mexico. It's very clean, easy to get around. A lot of interesting sights. You can go to tequila for the day.
That's awesome. I'm just realizing, I don't know if you've counted up how many countries you've visited, but do you know off the top of your head?
43.
I don't know what my number is, but it's less than 43. Yeah.
Have you been to all seven continents?
Yeah.
No?
Yes.
I'm at five continents and 44 countries.
Nice.
That's pretty good.
That's real good.
But
how is this just your first episode of this travel blog?
Well, I mean, I've been busy traveling. Exactly. I'm busy on the road. Been editing all these videos that I've got. All right. So then the big question on my mind is, where to next?
Our trip together next will be Finland. We're going to go see where Santa Claus lives and stay in some ice hotels. Go super far north in Norway, I believe, and go like ice fishing and snowmobiling and reindeer sledding.
Wow.
Dog sledding. Just a whole like magical winter experience for Christmas.
Yep.
Okay, but you said together.
Yes.
Are you going on individual solo treks?
I am headed to Europe to do a river cruise through multiple countries like Hungary. And Germany. So just doing like a European adventure and then doing 2 weeks in Romania.
We forgot before our Norway trip, we're going on the Amazon.
Yes, to see Amazon cruise.
I forgot about that. We're going with.
Oh, no. Yeah. Forgot about that.
We're going with family. So we didn't plan the trip.
Okay.
We were invited on the trip. So that's why it doesn't stick out in our head. Because if we don't plan it, then it's an incidental thing.
Okay, so what are you doing in Amazon?
We're just going up the river and going to the north, yeah, to try and find the pink dolphins.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that is a lot of exciting adventures coming up.
Yes.
I cannot wait to hear about them. We might have to have you back on after this is a smashing success on YouTube. But thank you both so much for being so gracious with your time and talking to me about this, because this was a conversation I wanted to have with you guys, whether we had these microphones in front of us or not.
Yeah, you can just throw all this out.
Yeah.
It'd still be a great
And we could have a couple beers and we're good.
Personal connection, that's all that matters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you so much, and like and subscribe.
You can't do double thumbs without everybody else.
Everybody has to do the double thumbs. Oh, wow. How long was that? I have no idea.